When she was 18, her father gave her the advice she needed to follow her dreams and become a writer. The next day, he had a heart attack and died in her arms. She did become a writer and a business owner and then a wife and mother. Today, after 13 books, a million of them in print, she's an award-winning syndicated columnist, a radio and TV host, and the owner of two successful companies. And now, Elise is here to help you rebuild your life. Stay tuned. This is gonna be good. This is the Elise Glink Show, rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours.
Episode of the Elise Glink Show. I'm Elise Glink. I'm here to help you make smart choices about your financial life. But first, I want to give you a word or two about the economy, which is a topic we refer to as Glinkonomics. The U.S. economy lost its stride in the first quarter of 2015. It didn't exactly shrink like it did in the first quarter of 2014, but it pretty much stopped dead in its tracks, growing at an annualized rate of only 0.2%. 0.2%. I'm Elise Glink. Here's today's Real Estate Minute. Analysts had expected a low number from the Commerce Department's Bureau of Economic Analysis, according to about 1%, according to a Wall Street Journal survey. The real number, or at least the first number, was even worse at 0.2%. With the margin of error, it's quite possible GDP went negative in the first quarter of this year. Economists reasoned that the harsh winter would put a damper on economic activity, and it did wind up being a really significant factor. And that's a big shout out to my friends who live on the East Coast. But my sense is this isn't the only problem our economy is facing. According to a report by Chico Harlan in the Washington Post, where I publish my weekly column, the St. Louis-based financial research firm Macroeconomic Advisors ran the numbers and estimated the winter did, in fact, slow the economy down by 0.8%. That could explain some of the disparity between the analysts' expectations and the Commerce Department number, which, to be fair, is a preliminary number. We'll get a better sense of how accurate that number is in a month when we get the second revision and then another revision down the line. But a lot of economists aren't sure that the economy this year will rebound to a 2% plus annual rate in the next quarter or two. In fact, they're now predicting the next quarter or two might be as dour as the first. So what's worrying them? Try negative interest rates in places like Switzerland, political instability in the Mideast and Latin America, and the fact that wages still haven't risen much in the past 20 years. If you're trying to buy or sell real estate, pockets in this economy are going to be strong, but it still looks to me like the economy is following the real estate path where everything is local, local, local. That doesn't speak much to national, national, national numbers, but if you're buying and selling real estate, it's something to pay attention to. All right, let's get on with the rest of today's show. So I've got three guests with me this week. First off, I'll speak with Rob Dietz. He's an economist with the National Association of Home Builders. He's such a great guest, and we're going to talk about the rise in multifamily home construction relative to single-family home building, which is not necessarily a positive sign for American consumers. And he also weighs in on what's going on with the GDP. I absolutely respect him, and I know you're going to like our engagement as much as I did. Next, I've got Derek Peterson on with me. He is the CEO of a publicly traded company called TerraTech. And I invited him to come on the show and tell me all about the headwinds facing marijuana ganjapreneurs, yes, that's a real word, as they navigate the real estate market and search for places to grow and sell their wares. What was interesting to me about this interview is how difficult it is to rent and even to buy the kind of real estate that these marijuana entrepreneurs need. Whether it's large-scale warehouses for growing facilities or it's retail places, he referred to it as like Starbucks would need, of course. Fascinating conversation. I know you're going to enjoy it. The third conversation is with Jerry Asensio. He's chair of the foundation arm of the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. They've just launched an initiative called the Hispanic Wealth Project that aims to increase Hispanic homeownership levels by 3.2 million households over the next 10 years. That is a really significant number. He's got some ideas on how he's going to get there. After that, I've got an answer for someone who wrote to me with a question about commercial real estate appraisals. If you've got questions for me, you know where to send them, questions@thinklink.com. And you can also send them to me through Twitter or Facebook. All right, that's this week's show lineup. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoy doing it. Let's get started. I've got Rob Dietz back on the show with me today to talk about a really interesting trend he just wrote about. He's an economist with the National Association of Home Builders, and he's been taking a longitudinal look, yes, you heard that right, at the home building recovery statistics that are coming out of the Census Bureau, which we just announced. The Census Bureau just announced some new numbers. We're going to get to those in just a minute. The big picture is where I want to start, though. Hey, Rob, welcome back to Big Money Real Estate.
Thanks for inviting me back.
Sure thing. All right, so we saw the number from GDP last week, and off air we were just starting to talk about it. The number was 0.2% for the first quarter of 2015. That's basically nothing. That may even be less than nothing. What do you think's going on there?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's effectively zero. It's the second year in a row that we've had a slow start. It's actually slightly better than the slow start that we had for 2014, where it was more than a negative 2% drop. So it's a weak start. You saw a lot of weakness in areas of the economy, including in the investment category, which includes home building. Home building was just marginally positive, but non-residential real estate investment was negative. So there was some pullback by business investment. We'll see if housing can kind of pull the economy as a whole as we move through 2015.
You know, it's interesting. We've been waiting for the home building construction industry to pull us out of the recession since, 2008.
Right.
Hasn't happened yet. We should be building between 900,000 to 1,000,001 new construction residential units. My view of it, I'm not the economist, you are, but I wear one at, you know, the office at home. But when I look at those numbers, I think we're not really increasing. And there are a whole lot of reasons, I think, for that. So you've got year over year that the pace of private single family construction spending increased 7.8%. And multifamily is up 23.4%. Those numbers sound really good. What's going wrong?
Well, the single family component is, even though it's growing, it's so far below the levels that we would consider normal. We have growth rates of 10% for this year, greater than that for 2016 on the single family side. Even with those growth rates, by the end of 2016, we're still at only about 80% of normal production levels that would be dictated by population growth and replacing older homes. So to the extent that home building has contributed to economic growth, and it has, I mean, we've created jobs, it's really been a multifamily story. And as you pointed out, that census number is a good indication of that. We're up more than 20% year over year on multifamily. It's just that single family component is lagging. This is a story about rental demand growing and the home buying demand, at least on the new construction side, lagging behind.
What's interesting is that you said, so multifamily is growing, and March we saw multifamily construction spending of almost $50 billion, and yet that was 2.1% lower than February. So that's kind of going the wrong way as well. We'd like to see all of this kind of increase. Let's talk about weather. You know, I always wanted to be a weather girl. It was a bad winter. In some cases, if you were on the East Coast, it was a worse winter than last year. Last year was a horrible winter for the Midwest.
Right.
And yet the numbers are still below and lousy. Can't all be about the weather is what I'm thinking.
I agree with that. You know, you look at the numbers. For example, we saw new home sales really weaken in the Midwest, particularly the Northeast. You can blame that on the weather. You know, when you see softness in new home sales and traffic numbers in the West, it's part of the ongoing story, which is for housing. This is a slow, modest, halting at times recovery. Even the multifamily numbers, month to month, you can get a lot of volatility in rental apartment growth. Now, on the single family side, what we really need to see is a big increase in household formation. Now, fortunately, there are clues that that may actually be happening. We now have two quarters in a row where the Census Bureau has indicated that household formations are growing at a rate of more than 1 million a year. That's kind of twice the rate that we saw just after the recession. And it's been one of the reasons that housing demand, both rental and for sale, has been weak. So if we see another quarter or two of that kind of rate of household formations, people moving out of apartments, moving out from their parents' couch. You know, maybe we won't be talking about the weather. We'll be talking about renters becoming home buyers going forward.
I don't know. I think that's a big leap. When I look at millennials who are out there, they've got huge debt. We've talked about this before. You know, they've got a huge amount of school debt. They've got credit card debt. If they're moving out for the first time, it's not like they're going to become home buyers next year.
Oh, absolutely.
So you could be talking about another 4 to 5 years before they gather enough money and get the credit necessary to actually move into their own place or to buy a place. Let's talk a little bit about what your longitudinal look at the census data actually is. I love that name. What are you looking for with that?
Just time trends. So, you know, again, we've got strong growth in multifamily. Single family is doing okay. One of the interesting things that comes out of some of the census construction spending numbers is that we've got a data point that we don't trust a whole lot, and that has to do with improvement spending. And in fact, it's actually kind of interfering with the headline number for residential construction spending that comes out of the Census Bureau. They've got improvement spending, basically remodeling growth, a strongly negative. And that doesn't make a lot of sense because usually remodeling occurs with existing home sales. And after some weakness in 2014, we've now seen, for example, in the pending home sales report, growth for existing home sales. So we're a little mistrustful of some of the improvement spending numbers. And in fact, our own industry data suggests that over the last 2 years, remodelers are fairly positive about the marketplace. So
yeah,
you know, census numbers are important, but we're looking at them with kind of a degree of skepticism.
I think that remodeling number is really sort of interesting, this improvement number, because we have had on one of the economists for House. And House is, of course, the website that everybody, you know, pins all of their stuff up on, what they want their houses to look like. And they do some looking at the different various numbers on what's going on with home improvement projects. And they were just on our show, they see a very strong summer coming up for home improvement projects. They think the numbers are big. The American Institute of Architects thinks the number is big for improvement projects. So it does seem that the census is a bit off. And I wonder, I know we have to account for a lot of how that's collected, but I wonder why it seems so wrong. I hope
there might
not
be
right.
A technical reason they might have to revise the numbers based on something called the Consumer Expenditure Survey, which is done once a year. That tells us kind of what households are spending money on. But yeah, our internal numbers, we have a remodeling market index that's strongly positive. The Harvard Joint Center and Housing Study numbers for remodeling is strongly positive. So remodeling's growing. We just have this one number from the census that's sort of at odds. And my guess is it'll be revised up to kind of match those other sources.
So about 10 days ago, I was fortunate enough to hear Austin Goolsbee, who's obviously a respected economist, and Randy Krosner used to be another economist on the Fed. They both are part of the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. And so we had an event at Booth, and they were both speaking. And both of them said they thought that the GDP number was going to be dreadful, which it is. And they also said they thought the next GDP numbers were going to be awful. And then looking backwards, it didn't look good. And they really didn't have a lot to say that's positive. And part of what they're looking at, I think, is how Europe has actually gone negative for interest rates. They specifically called out Switzerland, but you could say the same about a half a dozen other countries in Europe where if you put $100 into a bank in one of the ECB banks, you might get $98 back. Why there's a flood over here to the U.S. where if you put $100 in the bank, you'll get $100.25 back. That's seen as a whole lot better than losing money on the money. How much does that play into, first, mortgage interest rates? I mean, I don't know how the Fed can even raise rates in an era where you're looking at negative interest rates. That's a really big story that I think just isn't being talked about. But then also in terms of what's going on in this country with, you know, the strength of the economic recovery, there have to be other issues in the economy if the world is sort of flattening or even and going negative. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the strong dollar is obviously a concern because it reduces exports. So that's going to take a toll on economic growth. We know interest rates are going to go up in the United States. That will have an impact on housing. Although I think the bigger binding constraint is qualifying for a mortgage rather than the cost of capital each month. So, you know, you talked about student loans, accumulating that down payment. Some of those issues are stronger impacts for the housing market. I think there's also something to be discussed about in terms of regional growth. You know, 2014, we really benefited from the energy sector's growth, and that helped housing markets in places like Texas. We know there's some weakening there with oil price decline. So, yeah, I think now this is a story about some of these global conditions affecting the U.S. marketplace. But while I don't think the second quarter GDP numbers will be awful, I don't think they'll be like the first quarter. They'll be a little weaker than what we hoped, you know, 2 point something, certainly under 3%. But our long-run forecast for 2015 is, and 2016 is for 3% growth. And we think that's obtainable because there's still a lot of slack in the economy. And job creation, even though it got recently revised down for the end of the year, is still looking positive, at least better than in years past.
Let me just ask you one final question. Do you see the mom-and-pop home builders, the ones who build, say, 1 to 20 houses a year, do you see that those home builders are coming back, the mom-and-pop shops? They really got hit so hard in 2008, 2009, 2010. You lost a lot of people who were actually building, who had the wherewithal to build. Where do you see that growth coming? Is it coming back?
Yeah, some of them got into custom home building, sort of that higher end, which is one of the reasons that new home prices are rising. It has to do with the right type of home that's being built. I think that that mom and pop home builder, which really represents about 3/4 of single family production in the country, it's going to be a story about getting access to lots and access to labor. And those are really the big challenges for that small home builder right now. Can they get a lot to build on? Because they can get a construction loan from the bank, but they might not be able to get the loan to acquire the lot to actually develop it in the first place. And then once they have a customer lined up and a lot to build on, can they get the workers at the right time to build? And the story appears to be one of challenge, but I think in most cases they're going to be able to do that, and that's one of the reasons that we have single-family construction growing this year. It's that sort of smaller home builder in those smaller markets that's going to experience growth.
Interesting. Well, Rob, thanks so much for being with us. Rob Dietz is an economist at the National Association of Home Builders. I hope you'll come back again. I always have such a good time talking with you.
Yeah, great. Thank you.
All right. A couple of weeks ago, I got a lot of great information about the state of Hispanic homeownership from Marissa Calderon at the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. And today I have her colleague, Jerry Asensio, who is a former president of NAREP, on the show to talk with me about an initiative, a special initiative, from NAREP's foundation arm, which is aimed at increasing wealth in the U.S. Hispanic population by $2 trillion over the next 10 years. And a big part of that is actually pushing for higher homeownership rates within the Hispanic community. Jerry has also been named the chair of the NAREP Foundation, so he's quite literally, at least we hope so, the man with the plan. Jerry, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Thank you so much, Lisa. I'm glad to be here on the show. And yes, this is a very exciting plan that we are unveiling at this time.
Well, tell us a little bit about it. Give us the kind of the high level concept of it.
Absolutely. So what it is the NAREP Foundation, that would be the 501c3, actually works on this initiative over the next 10 years. It's called the Hispanic Wealth Project. And within that Hispanic Wealth Project, we have a lofty, a very bold and aggressive goal. And that is a plan to triple the Hispanic wealth, household wealth, within the next 10 years for all the families across America. We have a specific formula. We have a specific business plan, a blueprint, if you will, on how we're going to do that. And it's going to all come back to what we call an ecosystem, that ecosystem of Hispanic wealth creation being started off by, of course, employment. A Hispanic family needs to be employed. And once they're gainfully employed, out of that, they're going to receive income. Income is going to take them to where they're establishing credit. They're going to be also putting together savings. And those ingredients are the fundamentals that'll take them to home ownership, one of the three pillars of the blueprint, the foundation blueprint. Out of that home ownership, we see them going into entrepreneurship, where they can probably own their own business and then circle back and employ other people within their community. So that creates that ecosystem where it all comes back around and moves it forward.
Understood. So the goal, let's focus on the homeownership part of the leg of the stool, as you might say, to start.
Sure.
The goal is to get the homeownership rate for Hispanic families over 50%. The current rate is about 46%.
Yes, that is correct. And that, so we are currently at 45.4%. And so this is a trajectory or a goal over the next 10 years. So this will take us from the year 2015 all the way out to the year 2025. So we think that, you know, based on projections, based on demographics, the census reports and things like that, that in the year 2025, the Hispanic community will consist of approximately 20 million households. So that means that we would need to be at a net amount of 10 million homeowner households over the next 10 years. So, of course, this is a moving target because, as you said last time when you interviewed Marissa Calderon and spoke about the facts in the State of Hispanic Homeownership Report, you know, we're a moving target because of the explosive growth of our particular demographic. But what it's going to boil down to is an increase of 3.2 million homeowners net in the next 10 years. And that would be already considering the people that'll sell, if there are any, you know, foreclosure or default rates, people that'll transition, they'll go into alternative housing and those kind of things. After all that is said and done, we still need to be at a net increase of 3.2 million new homeowners over the next 10 years.
That seems like a pretty tough goal. Give me a couple of things that you're doing to try and lay the groundwork to get there.
Absolutely. Well, in order to achieve it, the initiatives are going to be NAREP directed, and we're definitely involved in it firsthand, and the other will be NAREP recognized. So let's talk about the ones that are NAREP driven, the ones that are directed by us. Number one, we're going to be addressing an underrepresentation of Hispanic workers in the financial and lending occupations. So we're looking at doubling the amount of Latinos and Hispanic that participate, both say primarily on the real estate side as real estate agents, practitioners, realtors, brokers, broker owners, those kind of things. And then on the financial side as loan officers, home mortgage consultants, and those type of things. So we need to double the amount of people that are participating. Why? Because we're going to be experiencing an explosive amount of increase in the amount of consumers that will need these services that are culturally competent, culturally sensitive, and maybe also in language. So that's the number one thing that we're going to try to drive right out of the gate.
Oh, that's pretty impressive. We'll have to see what happens. Are you sort of chunking it out so that, because 3.2 million or 3.2 million all in 1 year would be, I think, a very big bunch to swallow. But are you sort of chunking it out saying we'd really like to see maybe 300,000 a year new Hispanic homeowners per year over the next 10 years? And how are you finding those people exactly?
So these people are actually going to come to the system where once we get people more representation all across America, and with the way that Hispanics are so mobile, we're moving to different markets that sometimes we wouldn't even think is a high Hispanic population. And then once they get there and they get those jobs, then the next thing that they're going to want to do is plant the roots. As a matter of fact, I'll share with you that the words real estate, if you translate them to Spanish, it's bienes raíces, meaning rooted assets. So that's what we're expecting, that they are just going to organically come to us and look for that representation. And our responsibility and our deliverable is going to be to make sure that we have enough representation, both on the real estate as well as the lending side, to be able to satisfy that need and get them into sustainable Hispanic homeownership. Now, I want to remind you, this is the first time in 15 years that we've ever set an actual goal that talks about the percentage. So we've carefully analyzed it, what the tract has been, how many homeowners, you know, came out of homeownership following the mortgage meltdown, that whole debacle, and then where we want to be in the next 10 years. So it'll be approximately 320 net new homeowners per year, increase year over year, until we get to that 10-year goal of the 10 million, when we are then represented by about 20 million Latino households across America.
Perfect. Jerry Asensio is the chair of the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals Foundation. Jerry, thank you for giving us a little insight into that.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to accomplishing the goal.
We look forward to watching you do it, too. Now, I've got a new angle on real estate investing for you. What are the considerations that go into finding a property when you've just won 8 business licenses to legally grow and sell marijuana? Well, that's exactly what my guest today has been figuring out. Derek Peterson is the CEO of TerraTech, a publicly traded marijuana company that recently won 8 licenses to operate marijuana businesses in Nevada, where, for at least now, only medical sales of the drug are permitted. Hey, Derek, welcome to Big Money Real Estate.
Elise, thanks for having us on. I appreciate it.
Let's start out with a quick rundown of the legal situation and where you are right now. The CARES Act, proposed by Cory Booker and Rand Paul, would codify into federal law a provision allowing states to make their own decisions about legalizing marijuana. And that, I think, would help TerraTech, right?
You know, the biggest issue right now is a Schedule I narcotic. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. So from a federal standpoint, the activity of procuring, cultivating, distributing, et cetera, and so forth of medical cannabis is completely illegal under federal law. However, states have been enacting medical marijuana legislation from California to Nevada to New York, going through an application period right now. And this dichotomy between state and federal law has, you know, created a pretty complex environment for entrepreneurs to operate inside of. And one of the most difficult factors that we've been facing across the board has been procuring real estate for a plethora of different reasons, which I'm sure we'll discuss. But those two factors are very entwined with one another in order to have success. One of the reasons we were so successful in Nevada was we were fortunate enough to be able to secure real estate. There were other people that weren't even able to apply because they weren't able to find suitable real estate to suit the needs for their dispensaries, for their cultivation facilities, and or their production facilities. So the state law versus the federal law has made it a very difficult environment to operate in for a handful of reasons.
Well, at least you don't actually have to wander around with a wheelbarrow full of cash anymore, right? Small progress. But yeah. All right, so let's talk about the real estate challenges, because as a real estate investor, I would think this would be a terrific thing to have, right? I mean, this is something that everybody wants. There are lines out the door. What are some of the challenges in finding the right kinds of real estate?
There are several fold, and we'll cover all those. The one thing, going back to your original thought, is yes, these businesses are very attractive. If you look at an average retailer, whether it's Lowe's or Target or places like that, they do anywhere from, say, $200 to $300 or $400 of revenue per square foot per annum. Higher-end retailers like Cartier and Louis Vuitton, they'll do closer to 1,000. Apple Computers, which is an outlier in everything in life, does closer to 3,000. The average revenue per square foot that medical marijuana dispensaries will bring in is anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000. So the numbers are there. And the reason behind that is because...
Wow, it's like a Louis Vuitton store.
But with a better product.
Well, that's debatable, but okay.
So the biggest thing to deal with is so many of these application processes, and I'll talk to you about Nevada because we had just went through that, are built around or aligned around the actual real estate. So a person can't even come into a new locality or a new area and apply without having located and secured that particular real estate, which means if you're fortunate enough to find a lease, you're going to have mitigated your risk a little bit. If in the event that you don't get a permit, you don't have a long-term purchase that you have to flip a building down the line. And if you are, you know, looking for an acquisition or a purchase, those pools are pretty limited because a lot of the times the prices have gone up or you're zoned out of certain areas. There's a billion different levels of zoning issues that are put in and around these properties, again, reducing the pool of potential properties down to a very select few in most areas around the country.
If you're a real estate investor, how do I attract a business like you? What is it that you're looking for in your real estate that you're buying or leasing?
That's a great question. So we have a few different needs. We have cultivation. So cultivation is generally zoned light industrial. We're looking for a warehouse with a lot of power. So if you've got a lot of amperage run, you're a brick building, a solid structure building in an outlying area, that's generally what we're looking for. Most of the time, that's what the zoning is going to allow for. They're going to want those cultivation facilities away from residential neighborhoods.
And do you want the power because you've got lights and you're growing 24/7? You need a water supply, big water supply for this as well?
Yeah, the water isn't as much of an issue. Those can be solved, you know, using a plethora of different hydroponic technologies. But the power is generally a large issue because to run in new power, if power doesn't already exist there to that level, always can take months and months and months with the approvals and the permits that need to be taken place to get from point A to point B. But that's cultivation. Then there's retail. And the retail really is no different than what a Starbucks would be looking for. We're looking for, you know, a high traffic center, a good crossroads, good section of town. Preferably near residential neighborhoods and those types of things.
And you want parking, right? You want something that, you know, allows people to get on and off pretty easily or in and out. Do you do drive-through?
Some areas allow for it, some don't. Most of the time, we don't see that. They do allow for delivery, so you want a packing and sorting area. You want a back entrance where people have the ability to come in and pack a car up before they send it out for a delivery. And then you want an area you can secure, and that's a whole other variable to say a Starbucks wouldn't have to look for. We have a lot of cash in these facilities because of the banking regulation issues, another headwind that we suffer. And those need to be worked out through real estate that's appropriate, that allows us to, you know, to do business in a method that's conducive to our environment. And in managing large cash balances and having the ability to get in and out of the facilities easily is a huge metric for us as well.
What are you doing in terms of sales? I mean, I understand that is TerraTech publicly traded or not yet?
Yeah, TerraTech's publicly traded. We have a couple divisions. So we just got into actually what they call crossing the proverbial green line. So we just started jumping into the cannabis business now. We will build out our facilities throughout Nevada through the course of this year and early next year. So we won't have an idea of the revenue that these facilities are going to bring in till we get closer to the launch date. And then Nevada, for example, is potentially going to have recreational legalization there, which will change the ballgame quite drastically. As we sit right now, we do about $7 million a year. We have a produce division called Edible Garden, where we grow and cultivate hydroponically grown produce and sell throughout the Midwest and Northeast as well.
So you've got a bunch of different needs. It sounds like you've got some sort of warehouse growing kind of a need. You've got a retail need and something that's kind of a high trafficked area. Where are the locations that you're most interested in, and how should people find you if they've got real estate that might be interesting?
We're new. The closest market that's up for application right now is New York. So we're actually scouring most of New York areas for both retail as well as cultivation facilities. Florida is another area that's enacting legislation right now. If you're a real estate holder and you have an interest to making certain that your property is put up in these different areas for entrepreneurs to take a look at, start to look around the country at who's permitting, who's going through a legislative process, who's releasing applications, and then, you know, market your particular property associated with that. We as entrepreneurs, like I said, for the handful of different reasons that we discussed, that pool of potential properties is extremely limited because A, of zoning, and B, there's not a lot of landlords that want to incur the potential forfeiture risk that exists. Now, because of the bipartisan support and the swings that we've seen politically, a lot of that risk has been alleviated, but there still is the legal risk that the government could come in and take the property from these owners, which reduces the potential pool of lease options to next to nothing. And it slightly increases the ability to be able to purchase buildings because most people don't want to act as a landlord in this particular environment. But because of that, people are charging significant premiums on both the purchase side, but especially on the lease side for somebody that's willing to incur that risk.
I can imagine so. Derek Peterson, thank you so much. That was really interesting information and very helpful to our audience.
Thanks, Lise, for the time. Appreciate you having us on.
Sure. Derek Peterson is the CEO of TerraTech. Not too long ago, I got a question from a 20-something first-time investor about leveraging debt versus building equity in real estate. He asked whether I would recommend reaching a specific level of equity in a rental unit before purchasing another property. So here's what I'm thinking. When I look at debt versus equity, I'm always choosing, when it comes to investing in real estate, to get a bigger mortgage, especially when interest rates are historically low like they are now, on the investment properties I own with my husband and my friend, so that we could write off the expense of the interest against the income the property generates. So that's me. We purchased an investment condo, for example, with an interest-only loan. We put 20% down, plus we paid another chunk for upgrades. When we bought it from the blueprints, I can't even believe this. It might be even 7 to 10 years ago. It's hard to remember. It might be 10 years ago we bought it, and then 7 years ago we closed on it. We had an adjustable rate mortgage on that property, and we've managed to stay cash positive for basically the whole time up until this last rate, you know, increase. Today, it's been tough to purchase investment property with less than 25 to 35% in cash. And once you own 4 residential properties, including your primary residence, you may find it difficult to get any sort of financing for an investment property through Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae, even though you used to be able to get up to 10 properties total. And today, that's just really hard to do. Building a portfolio of rental properties or other types of investment real estate means making connections with several commercial lenders who will be able to guide you on what kind of equity they want to see in order to provide financing. And you want to find somebody who really specializes in the kind of property you're buying. So if you're buying strip malls, find a strip mall lender. I just heard today from a guy who's at SunTrust. He just moved to SunTrust. And I asked him what he's looking for, and he said he's looking to provide financing $10 to $50 million. You go to him with a $5 million property loan, he's not going to be interested. He's looking at $10 to $50 million. So there's hyper-specialization going on as well. So some lenders are going to require that you put down 35% in cash for deals 2, 3, or 4 or any commercial, but by the time you own a half a dozen properties, particularly if each has a significant number of units, and by significant I mean usually more than 3 or 4, you may be able to refinance all of the properties together with a single loan, and there's pluses and minuses to that strategy, so you're going to want to think it through. Keep in mind that the amount of debt you carry on your investment properties must be repaid. This is not like you buy it and never pay it back. So the rental income that you have needs to be considered, right? And how stable those rents are. Your federal income tax situation, other details relating to the number of properties that you might want to buy in the future, in making your decision. This is all going to be key to making the decision, the smart decision about how much debt to carry relative to the equity over the long run. Because there are always going to be hard money lenders, also known as private money lenders, and we've had some of those interviews, who will be willing to do a zero, what would effectively be a zero down on these properties. That is really risky, and tread with caution. The best piece of advice I can offer is to not do all this on your own. So sit down with a bunch of different lenders so that they can walk you through the different scenarios that could affect this decision of how many properties to buy, where to buy them, how much debt to carry. You should definitely build a group of trusted advisors who will help you create your own real estate investment portfolio and the strategy behind it. Strategy is key for whatever you're going to be doing. And if you take the right steps and you continue to make this a central goal, I have no doubt you're going to get where you want to go. There are three quick tips I want you to know if you're going to make a really smart real estate investment. Number one, look for properties where you can build in value. It seems obvious. I published a story on my Money Watch blog about the properties you can purchase for $40,000 or about the price of a luxury car or a cheap luxury car. These homes aren't necessarily in moving condition, but they're not falling down either. The goal is to find property that costs less than everything else in the neighborhood, even after you make the required repairs. In other words, let's say you purchase a home for $100,000 when everything else in the neighborhood that's not a distressed property is priced at $200,000. Let's say your property needs $60,000 worth of work. When you add that amount to the purchase price, you're still winding up with a property that has some sort of profit margin. And yes, folks, this is all about profit. You can either flip it or you can hold it for the long run, renting out the property to pay expenses and generate positive cash flow. Here's number two, buy a multi-unit property. I've known dozens, maybe even hundreds, of people who have bought multi-unit properties over the years, lived in one of the units, and used the remaining units to defray their cost of living and leverage up their investment. How does this work? Let's say you buy a four-unit building for $500,000. Each unit has 2 bedrooms, 2 baths. If you live in one of the units, well, that allows you to rent out the other 3 apartments. If each of those brings in, say, $1,500 a month, and this, of course, these numbers are going to depend where you live and where you're buying this place, that's $4,500 per month in income that the property is generating, or $54,000 a year. Now, the property may have $10,000 in real estate taxes, and that would leave you with $44,000 to put towards the mortgage. And that amount will certainly cover the mortgage and any upkeep that the property requires. The goal, again, is to find real estate that will allow you to maximize the leverage on your investment. So if you could only afford to spend $150,000 on a single-family property, but can actually afford a $450,000 property that generates some income, you may be better off buying the larger property, although it seems like you're putting so much more on the hook. On a net basis, and let me be really clear about this, you might make more money than with a single-family property appreciating at the same rate, and you may have a bigger tax deduction and tax benefits over time. Here's tip number three. Do you own a small business? Consider buying your building rather than renting an office. If your business is relatively steady and profitable, right, so it's not really growing and changing like crazy, you may want to look into buying a building that you can use as an office rather than moving to rent a bigger office. Lot of positives here. By purchasing a building, you'll be able to use your rent to pay down your mortgage and build equity in the property. Now, your accountant might even suggest that you own the building personally and have the company sign a lease renting it from you to maximize tax opportunities. If you're growing, you could purchase a bigger property than you might need now and rent out the other part of the building until you're ready to move into it. A friend of mine did that in Florida. If your business outgrows the whole property, then you can just rent it to someone else or divide the space and rent to two someone else's. And actually, I like that model where you and a different business are leveraging off each other, because that gives you even more opportunities. Either you're going to grow and take over the whole space, or they're going to grow and take over the whole space. You move out, you find another rent tenant. They move out and you find another tenant. So there's four different ways that this could work out. Now, there are plenty of ways to profit from the purchase of investment real estate, but I think the time to buy is now, because interest rates are still at historic lows and real estate values are still not back to where they were in their highs back in 2004, 5, and 6. Hey, I hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Elise Kling Show, and I just want to give a big thanks and shout out to all of our guests. They were amazing, and I love when I learn things. If there's anything you missed, don't worry. You can find the show notes to this episode at thinkglink.com. That's think, T-H-I-N-K, glink, G-L-I-N-K.com. If you're new to the show, be sure to subscribe and rate it. If you're a regular listener and haven't done so, please go back and give the show a ratings or review on iTunes. You can do that by searching for the Elise Kling Show in the podcast section of iTunes. And when you do this, this helps the show get discovered by new listeners. And I would love for you to tell all your friends and family about this. I've also got another new venture that's going on here that I want to let you know about, called Monday Morning Marketing with Elise Kling and John Byrne. John Byrne has been my neighbor for at least 10 years, at least I think it's 10 years. He was my neighbor down the hall, and he is a former chief marketing officer of a huge international law firm. He left that about a year or so ago to form a content marketing company like mine, but he focuses on the legal community. The two of us have these incredible conversations, and I really thought that you would enjoy hearing it. So what I've done is on Fridays, we flip open the mic in my studio and the two of us talk. Sometimes it's 30 minutes, sometimes it's 45 minutes. It's always really entertaining to me, and I think you're going to like it as well. So we're going to put a link on this show, where it is, over to Monday Morning Marketing. Sign up for my free weekly newsletter at thinklink.com, and you're going to start getting some emails about it as well. But I wanted you to be the first to know. We've just done three episodes. They are up and running. Let me know what you think. All right, this brings us to the end of another episode of the Elise Kling Show. I'm your host, Elise Kling, and I'll be back next week with another new episode. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great week, everybody.